When we think about American cuisine, we don't think about California. There is no cuisine of California. There's ingredients, beautiful ingredients. Cuisine is, how do you eat the whole farm? How do you eat the whole landscape? That's a cuisine. That is Southern cooking. All of those things that we think about as some of the most delicious Americanized food came out of desperation. It came out of, how do you take depleted soils and make them filled with fertility?
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. When we launched Politicology, we committed to exploring how politics touches every part of our lives together. Well beyond the election horse races and what's happening in Washington, that at its core, politics is how we decide what to do in the shared parts of our lives. We talked about how politics affects the water we drink, the air we breathe, the food we eat, and that's exactly what we're going to be talking about today. Food is political. From what we grow, to who grows it, and how much it costs, to what food we have access to and who cooks it, food is a central part of our shared lives. I'm excited about today's episode because I'm sitting here with someone I've long admired and wanted to meet since all the way back in 2015 when the hit series Chef's Table featured him and his groundbreaking work in their inaugural season. Chef Dan Barber has been described as America's philosopher chef. He is most well known as the chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. Between the two restaurants, he has 3 Michelin stars and has been awarded a Michelin Green Star for the work at Blue Hill at Stone Barns. Under President Obama, Dan served on the President's Council on Physical Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. Time magazine even named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He's been the recipient of numerous James Beard Awards, including Best Chef and Outstanding Chef, and for writing and literature for his book, The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Chef Dan, welcome to Politicology, and thank you so much for making the time today.
Thank you.
So before we dig in, I would love to have you set the table for our listeners by briefly describing at the present moment where you think we currently find ourselves in the story of American agriculture. What do you see as the successes and the problems in the way America eats and the way we feed ourselves?
Well, more has changed in food in the last 60 years than in the last 600. And for the most part, food has gotten less ecologically sound in its production practices, less fair in its farming practices, less healthy in the food we eat, and definitely less delicious. So on all accounts, eaters are losing out in the game of feeding ourselves 3 times a day. And it's true that we are feeding a lot of people more cheaply than we did 60 years ago. But the costs of that, both on our environment and on our health, are astronomical. And I think we're just getting a glimpse of what that looks like now in pollution, in soil degradation, and now in COVID. I mean, what could be more striking than just the data that's coming out of COVID, in the midst of it is just so alarming. It's 92% of COVID deaths are underlying conditions, 92%. So the underlying conditions, when you look at them, are 3 things. I think it's 95% of the 92%, okay, are 3 things. One is diabetes, the other is obesity, and the other is hypertension or some heart-related. So all 3 of those are diet-related diseases. You know, it's food that is killing us in COVID. Food. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. You know, I'm not suggesting that that's our vaccine, but one could argue that that's our vaccine, and that we have been handed a food system that is killing us, literally. And COVID just peels that back. I mean, nothing is new in those statistics. It's just that you have a virus that comes along and we are just exquisitely vulnerable to it. You know, I was just this morning, I was on the phone with a Rockefeller scientist. He told me something, I think it's going to stay with me. Let me make sure I get this right. But he said, we were talking about these underlying conditions. You know, he said, most of them are comorbidity, which means you have one, more than one of the 3.
Right.
But he said, you know, if you could just isolate for diabetes, is that we looked at the statistics of diabetes, it's type 2 diabetes, it's adult onset diabetes. He said, you know, in 1975, there were so many fewer cases in 1975. In other words, America didn't have the issue with type 2 diabetes that it has today, to the extent that if COVID hit in 1975, it would have been a bad flu season, just on the type 2 alone. And type 2, as we know, there's nothing more diet-related than that. So I think coming out of COVID, when we come out of it, whatever it is here as we emerge, is a better appreciation and consciousness around food and how it affects our health. Because as I said, it's deadly.
So your book is titled The Third Plate. Can you explain how you developed the concept and lay out what the first, second, and third plates are?
Yeah, the first plate is the plate that our grandparents, you and me, our grandparents, and maybe even our parents grew up on, and that's the American protein-centric steak lunch and steak dinner. And it's from a cow that's been fed, a lot of grain, and that steak is cheaper than it ever was. There's a smattering of like vegetables and a little bit of grain, but essentially it's a primary piece of protein that's centering the plate twice a day, 7 days a week. The second plate is the more recent emergence of this farm-to-table food consciousness plate of food. And that has a lot to do with a protein-centric plate of food that is grass-fed, let's say, in the case of beef, or it's from a regional organic pork producer. And there's still a smattering of vegetables, but the vegetables are more often than not local, because there's this explosion in farmers markets and CSAs and supermarkets that carry local produce. And then there's some grains on the plate, and they're either organic or more and more whole grains, which is a great development. So the second plate's a lot better than the first plate. But my argument is, when I studied it, was that the architecture of that plate of food is still the same. And that's protein-centric, where we are relying, we're taking our natural resources and devoting it to the most unsustainable and wasteful diet in the history of the world, which is the Western diet, it's the American diet. We today we grow 200 million acres of corn and soybeans on some of the greatest farmland in the world, in the history of the world. and we don't eat any of it. We feed it either to, mostly to cows. We feed a little bit to make plastic and gasoline in our gas tanks. But for the most part, that energy, that food, that sustenance is going through a cow or eating the cow. So that is about the most inefficient a system you could ever create.
Yeah.
And it's allowing us, because of our tax dollars, supporting that system to eat very essentially cheap meat, but at a great cost. So the third plate is a recommendation to change the architecture of the plate. And that's what's happening in restaurants around the world with chefs that are rethinking what a plate of food should look like. And they're doing it in this pursuit of deliciousness, which is really at the heart of the whole book and the heart of my work, is the pursuit of deliciousness. Because, as you know, if we start pointing a finger at people for what they eat and indict them for their diet choices, it'll last about as long as this conversation. You know, it doesn't stick. Yeah. So what we need to do is become not armies of virtue, but armies of greed and hedonism.
Yeah.
And chefs are, good at creating that kind of context of delight and pleasure around the table. And so I'm arguing for a plate of food that's not vegetarian. I'm not a vegetarian.
Right.
It's about eating meat, but eating a lot less meat. For example, last night at Blue Hill, you came in and you would have 30 courses at my restaurant, generally a tasting menu. I'd say probably 15 to 20 of those had meat in them, but you didn't have one single plate of food where there was a overwhelming protein-centric plate. Not one.
Where it was a meat dish.
It was a meat dish, yeah. I sort of played with that at the end of the meal last night. We did a steak of these incredibly delicious carrots. We've left the carrots in the ground up until the last freeze. That means they were planted in March. They almost made it a year. But we took them out right before last freeze. And we tested them for sugar. They were like 17% sugar. I mean, these things were like candy sticks. And I roasted them for 12 hours. And they're the most beautiful. And I glazed them in meat sauce. It wasn't a vegetarian dish, but we carved it like a steak. So table set at the table. And we served it with potatoes and cream spinach. And it was like just like a steak dinner. And then after people had this, we came around with a slice of steak on the side, you know, and it was to say like this is the proportion we should be eating meat in, you know, we should lead with these root vegetables, these whole grains, and we should enjoy the right kind of meat that's raised on grass and grass alone, because that produces the most ecologically beneficial return, the most nutrition per bite, and absolutely the most flavor. And it's free because the sun feeds the grass feeds the cow, and the cow feeds us. It's one of the great natural inventions that we can take advantage of. But we have to do it in accordance with the carrying capacity of what the land can provide. And that, for us, last night was a little side of steak after you had your carrot steak dinner.
That sounds delicious. I'm going to make a lot of people hungry now, I think. I want to dig in more to the pursuit of deliciousness, as you put it. I think in the current context, we have this notion that food that tastes good must be bad for you. Can you talk about the agricultural concessions that led to this perception, and then what you found about the connection between flavor and nutrition when you started breeding seeds for flavor?
Yeah, I don't know where the food that's good for you has to taste bad comes from. Our Puritan background, where you have to make sacrifices left, right, and center. I'm Jewish. I have to make sacrifices everywhere too. And we don't have that perception of food either. So I don't know. I don't get it, except the last time we tried virtuousness around food production and high moral ethical standards was really the hippie movement in the late 60s and 70s, where, you know, white food, you know, everything was brown and everything was virtuous, but nothing tasted good. You know, and that movement didn't last.
Right.
Couldn't be more high-minded and more moral than what those people were talking about. That was really the birth of organic. It was about a whole organism. It wasn't about the particular thing of what you ate only, or how it was farmed. It wasn't just that there was no pesticides or fertilizer. It was that who was growing in it? How was it growing it? How was it being grown? Who was getting it to you? I mean, it was the whole, that's organic. It's an organism, the one whole thing. It was very smart. It was a very thoughtful, connected, and appropriate look at how we should be eating. The problem was the food didn't taste good. And so I don't know. I think we're living off of a lot of that perception, like that kind of food that's virtuous is terrible. When in fact, as we know, if you look around cuisines and cultures around the world that are mainly based on indigenous peasant heritage foodways, they were trying to eke out what the land could provide,
right.
Just eke out enough to feed themselves or family and their neighbors. And figure out a pattern of eating that supported that kind of agricultural landscape. And that's the history of cuisine. That's the history. In many ways, cuisine and culture are one and the same thing, because you're figuring out not just patterns of eating, but you're figuring out from that the way you live your life. And you cannot eat a steak twice a day, 7 days a week. That's not allowed. That's when I say carrying capacity land. That wasn't allowed. Before we had chemical agriculture, you could not do that. And what that ended up spurring is a creativity around cuisine and ultimately culture that expresses a place, a sense of place, and a sense of history and who you are as people. I mean, look, here's an example. This came to mind. Like, you go to Japan, and you'll probably end up having rice twice a day, 7 days a week. Okay, so that's a nice analog to our meat expectation. But the ability to grow rice, that much rice for your country, you had to have a very intense rotation system of crop farming that allowed you to have the fertility and the breakup disease cycles to get you the rice. So barley and buckwheat were two crops that worked very well on most of Japanese soil. And what did they do, you know, with the buckwheat? They didn't have Dan Barber wagging their finger and saying, you know, if you're going to have your rice, you better eat your buckwheat, because buckwheat cultivation into rice cultivation it works and it gets you your rice. No, what they did is made soba noodles, you know? So you have soba noodles 3 or 4 times a week, not because you want to eat your rice, but because it's delicious, you know? And if you take that as a parable for, actually, it's not really a parable. It's the truth of, look at every cuisine around the world. I mean, look at, we think of Mexico, we think of the global South or Mexico, we think of Mexico as corn and masa and those incredible masa interpretations. Oh my God, this is so delicious. Of 800 different kinds of corn, every square mile, unbelievable. But actually it's bean culture because you couldn't have any of that corn without beans. And that's why beans are everywhere in Mexican food because it's the nitrogen for the corn.
Mm.
You know, it's in India, you have, wheat is one of the king crops, but you have to have lentils into wheat because that's the leguminous crop that gets you the wheat. In the Western Hemisphere, of course, it's wheat, but barley into wheat is the rotation crop all over Europe. So beer and bread are synonymous. I mean, that's true. Italy, same thing. Everywhere you look, there is a slew of cover rotation crops that gets you the king crop. And in our circumstance, wheat is the king crop. Global South is corn, and in the East is rice. And all those cultures and cuisines over thousands of years figured out how to get that king crop out of the ground through a meticulously timed rotation of hundreds of other crops that allow you to have the fertility to get you that crop that you want. That's cuisine. So you eat in accordance with how you're farming and what you can eke out of a landscape. That's not a deprivation. That's exciting as hell. Yeah. That's exciting as hell. Yeah. We just in America, look, we don't do it because we were never forced into those kind of negotiations. We're young.
Yeah.
You know, the countries I just mentioned, I've been farming for 4,000 years. Soils are exhausted.
Yeah.
So they didn't have the luxury that we had, which is to come over here and throw a seed in the ground and you're in the Garden of Eden. I mean, that's what happened. You know, the English, they came, I mean, it's not like anybody knew how to farm. If you knew how to farm, you had farmland, you know? You didn't have farmland. So you came over here and what happened? You were the luckiest person in the world because you, east of the Mississippi, you had virgin soils and you had rainfall. There are very few places that have virgin soils, rainfall and temperate climates. I mean, that just like doesn't happen. So, you know, it was very successful. And when soils started to crash on the East Coast, and really the production of food was really in the South. I mean, it was Virginia South or Maryland South is where, you know, agriculture was in the early 1700s and through the 1700s, 1800s. And what happens? You know, we were exporting rice, tobacco, wheat, vegetables all over the world, not just to the colonies, not just the East Coast, but all over the world. We export market. And the soils collapsed. The great soil crisis of the 1820s, farmers dropped their plows. And where'd they go? They plowed up the Midwest. We always talk about manifest destiny this calling. It wasn't a call. It was a calling to eat. and there were virgin soils. And we plowed up the prairie. And what's interesting about that, and by the way, we're now at California, you know, very recently at California. California is like a very recent agricultural invention. It's like last 100 years. That's California. Even one could argue in 50 years.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
detour.
It means that we lost fertility on the East Coast in the 1820s, and we were forced into the Midwest, plowing up the prairie. By the way, the U.S. government made that happen. The Homestead Act, among many others, just gave you free land. Mm. And if you could claim the land and farm it, you had to farm it. They didn't tell you how you had to farm it. They didn't tell you what you
just
had to farm.
Something.
Just grow something. And of course, we grew tons of wheat, corn, and other staple crops that ended up becoming our American diet. And there was a lot of land and a lot of free access to land. And that was the beginning of our lack of food culture because we were never forced into negotiations that every other country, culture, cuisine had for thousands of years. When we ran out of soil fertility there, we kept going to California. And, you know, since the 1960s, California has been the real breadbasket. But how much water is left? How much fertility is left?
Mm-hmm.
Degradation everywhere you look in terms of natural resources anyway. And how long are we going to prop that up for? So we're at the end of the line is my point of living high on the hog. And high on the hog's the first plate. To a certain extent, it's the elitism second plate.
Right.
We need a whole new understanding and conception of food. And it cannot be out of deprivation or sense of deprivation. It has to be a sense of delight, pleasure, hedonism. Because, you know, Americans, like, I don't want to get too down on America because they just said there's no food culture. And so, you know, it's kind of hopeless. It's not hopeless because of one thing that I think about a lot is Americans are very good at greed. you know, is the one thing that we just have perfected. It's like when we like something, we're willing to pay more for it, and we're willing to go out of our way to get it. And if it gives us pleasure, we're great at pursuing it. You can't say that.
That's true.
Actually, for a lot of other countries, I mean, especially when food, when you think about food in the last, let's say, 10 years, the dizzying speed that things get introduced in America. Just think of this Greek yogurt. Where was Greek yogurt 10 years ago? I mean, it was in Greece, literally. And it was a bunch of chefs who love the viscosity of that and love the adaptations you could do with Greek yogurt. And that took off. And today Greek yogurt is, you know, in Walmart. And you know, kale, where was kale? Kale. I mean, sushi, where was sushi? All of the, now think about Japan.
Yeah.
Think about France. Think about Italy. Think about India. Do you think those food cultures shift with that kind of dizzying speed? No, that is a very good sign of what's possible. And I think we're seeing it now. We're seeing millennials and Generation Z especially are asking some serious questions about how food is produced and want serious answers and are not dumbed down to advertising and the rest of the thing. And I think that's, you know, ultimately we're playing a very nice long game if we keep to that hedonism and delight. By the way, the problem with the hedonism and delight is in one of the, in an example I gave is the Greek yogurt. Because look, we developed a taste overnight, not even overnight, in seconds for Greek yogurt. And well, what happened to the whey that strained off to make Greek yogurt? You make Greek yogurt by taking regular yogurt, you strain off the whey, right? And you get the richness of yogurt that you don't get from a full-fledged yogurt. So what happens to the whey? Well, in upstate New York, there was, still is a terrible issue with leftover whey because the farmers, the dairy farmers, deliver the milk, and then the manufacturers make you take back the whey because they have no use for the whey. So what do you do with the whey? You dump the whey, and dumping whey is a toxic sourced elements and toxic waste for soils at a certain level in upstate New York. All these problems in Wisconsin with it too. I mean, that's a nice parable for what's wrong with a food system that doesn't create a pattern of eating, and there's no culture to it. The culture is what happens in Greece. You eat Greek yogurt, but you also eat lamb marinated in whey, and you drink elixirs all summer that are whey-based for protein and for your microbiome and your overall health and the skin of every Greek person you look at, right? It's like that comes from the whey. But in America, we have no culture for drinking whey or eating whey or using it in our food. So it gets dumped and it becomes a waste. And what we need to figure out is a pattern of eating and an orchestration of our food system that is reflected in our diets. That is delicious. That is delicious. I'll give you one more hopeful thing because my yogurt thing didn't end up being so hopeful. Here's my hopeful thing. What happened when those farmers dropped their plows and moved to the Midwest with free land? Who was left behind was largely slave owners, but slaves. And slaves, interestingly, came from parts of Africa that had deep agriculture traditions. I mean, in part, that was the interest in slaves, so the free labor is the knowledge and the work ethic and the knowledge. And what they brought with them was seeds and know-how. And they knew about rotations. And what came out of the horrible blight on our history of slavery was in part some of the greatest lessons in cuisine and patterns of eating. When we think about American cuisine, we don't think about California cuisine. I mean, there is no cuisine of California. Right. There's ingredients, beautiful ingredients.
You put that in air quotes.
Yeah, right. A cuisine is how do you eat the whole farm? How do you eat the whole landscape? How do you eat a whole ecology? That's a cuisine. That is Southern cooking. You know, the Carolina Rice Kitchen, Creole cooking. All of those things that we think about as some of the most delicious Americanized food came out of desperation. It came out of how do you take depleted soils and make them filled with fertility? You know, we're going to eat rice, but in America or in the South, you're going to not have buckwheat into rice because that doesn't work on those warm soils. You need stuff like cowpeas because cowpeas provide the nitrogen that's needed and they grow in a short season. And that's what, a high heat, high humidity environment will tolerate. So you create dishes like Hop and John's. You know, Hop and John's is 50% cowpea and 50% white. It's the same thing as the soba and the rice. You know, if you want your rice in the South, you have to eat your cowpeas. And by the way, you know, something called collard greens desalinate soils. So soils that are salinated are sick soils, soils that have been depleted of all nutrients and become salinated. To desalinate, you do it through collards and sweet potatoes. Collards and sweet potatoes are bedrocks of Southern cooking because it was a return to fertility and a return to what could be produced. And so sweet potatoes are all over Southern cooking, and so are collards. But that's the kind of, but you don't look at sweet potatoes, collards, rice, and cowpeas, and pork, which was not big honking pieces of pork chops, but smatterings of pork in things like Hop and John's and all these other dishes. You don't think of Southern cooking as deprivation cooking.
No.
We think of it as the most celebratory, delicious, hedonistic cooking. But it came out of deprivation, not just the slavery aspect of it, which in and of itself was so horrific, but the farming practice were desperation to return soils to any kind of productivity. And that, to me, is a very hopeful thing. That's a very joyous thing. And it's based on history. It's based on taking seed and genetics and farming know-how and infusing massive diversity. But you have to have the food culture mimic that call to diversity and necessity of farming to support the ecology. That's the ticket.
Okay, so we don't have a food culture and we've depleted our soil because of commercial agriculture practices. Right. Is there an incentive yet to changing the way commercial agriculture is done? And if there is, clearly there isn't enough of an incentive yet, what would those incentives have to look like to change the machine?
You know, if you had asked me that question when I was writing The Third Plate, I would say, Farm to table. Look, I started out writing The Third Plate because I wanted to write a recipe book about farm to table. Because in 2014, it was the most exciting social movement in America, and still very exciting, but it was really hitting its apex then. And I wanted to write a little story about what is the recipe? How do you, you know, it started with a loaf of bread that I baked at the restaurant. Seriously, when I opened Blue Hill Stone Barns, I was one of the few chefs. So many chefs were doing farm to table, but I was really digging into it with the farm. I wasn't farm to table. I was a restaurant in the middle of a farm, so I was really had skin in the game.
Yeah.
And I was looking at grains and only using local grains. And one of these farmers that I got to know was selling me an emmer wheat, which is an old biblical wheat, and it produced this bread. I fresh milled it, you know, and then we baked it right after milling it. It was so jaw-droppingly delicious, you know. It was like that thing that, you know, our customers sell their firstborn to have another slice of. So I got really well known for it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to write a book about farm to table. I'm going to start with grain because no one thinks of local, regional farm to table with grain. At least back then they didn't. So I go to this guy, Klaus Martin's farm in Western New York, and I'm standing there. It was like literally the first 5 minutes, okay? And I'm looking around and I see barley in the fields. It's 2,000 acres. So we were at a perch where I could look literally 360. Nice. So I see barley, I see buckwheat, I see rye, I see millet, and I see all these leguminous crops, I see cover crops, I saw brassica crops, and I see this little tiny little slice of wheat. And it dawned on me that first 5 minutes, I was like, wow, I am the emperor without clothes. Because what I'm looking at is a full-on system of truly regenerative farming. These are crops that this farmer Klaus farms in meticulously timed rotations around and around the farm. And when his soil is locked and loaded with the kind of fertility and lack of disease that he fungal and otherwise that he has ready to go, then he'll go with the wheat. Because the wheat is a soil sucker. I mean, if fertility has massive needs for fertility. So you have to have your soil in such prime condition that you get a wheat crop that gives me that jaw-dropping delicious emmer wheat that I became famous for. But what was I doing to support the rest of the farm? Zero. And where did the rest of the farm's crops go? Well, Klaus didn't have a market for any of that stuff. I mean, nobody eats barley and buckwheat. We don't have the soba equivalent here, right?
Right.
So it all goes into animals. It gets dumped into animals for pennies on the dollar. So Klaus loses money essentially on all the crops, except for the wheat and some of the corn that he was growing organically, and charges me top dollar. So what I just described isn't just an emperor without clothes, which I felt like I was in that minute. I really, for me, it was a before and after moment. I feel like, you know, I never cooked the same again. Actually, I went home after that trip and I created this dish that I was serving last night still 10 years later. It's called rotation risotto. And I took everything from Klaus's farm, the buckwheat, the barley, the millet, the rotation crops, the cover crops, the leguminous crops, and I made a risotto. And there's no rice. No rice is grown where he is. But I did, and no wheat. So I did everything, and I created a risotto, called it rotation risotto. And everyone was like, what's rotation risotto? But I was like, if you're going to have a piece of bread for your next course, which everybody wanted when they came to my restaurant, you're going to have to eat the crops that give you that bread.
And
that
to make the soil.
Yeah, to make the soil fertile enough to give us not just a wheat, a local wheat, but a exceptionally delicious wheat. And so that's how, to this day, we serve some type of lowly rotational grain crop before we serve the bread, because that's your tax. You know, if you want to eat your wheat, that's what you need to do. Same idea, buckwheat, soba, buckwheat, and rice, bowl of rice. Same idea. So you know, that I don't even know if I answered your question there, but I got off on a tangent.
The question is really about incentives, but is that risotto, did you serve that at family meal?
I served it family meal. I've served in because different iterations all the time. Did you go to family meal?
I went to family meal in October. It was my first time, and I think that was my favorite dish,
actually.
Oh,
man, that's nice
to
hear.
The risotto was my favorite dish.
That's nice to hear. Thank you.
But the question is about, and maybe the answer is flavor. I don't know. But the question is, I think you're right about finger wagging and getting people to change, right? It doesn't work that way.
No.
The machinery, the chains, the systems will change when there's an incentive to do so for the rational actors. What do the incentives need to look like for the way we don't honor the soil, the way we have not had to negotiate with the soil the way other cultures and countries have had to do to produce their food culture? We have never had to do that.
Right.
We have something different here, and I don't know how it changes.
To me, I mean, look, you're talking to guys wearing a white chef's coat, you know, and I could be wearing a white doctor's coat, medical doctor's coat, because those are one and the same thing. You alluded to that in a previous question I never answered, but taste, flavor, true jaw-dropping deliciousness that I described in that wheat is nutrition. I mean, it's flavonoids. Mm. Flavonoids are flavor. Flavor is, and flavor, nutrition, same thing. I've studied this now so much with breeders that work a lot with seed breeders. And you start to see where in genetic lines that breeders are selecting for you, at some point you have a choice. Breeding flavor is over here, and yield and uniformity is here. And you have to make it, there's like a, you know, there's a what do you call it, in a road, a fork in a road. And you make a choice. And I think that the best way to convince people of the right patterns of eating is to make food as delicious as it could and should be. Because like I said, you don't complain when you go to Japan and eat your soba noodles. You don't complain. You don't complain when you go and eat your lentils in India. You don't complain when you go and eat your teff and millet in North Africa. You know, you don't complain. You know, you don't complain about beans in Mexico.
Right.
You know, so we just need to figure that out and create a food culture that covets those kind of foods in America and stop this living high on the hog deal. We've lived off of virgin soil. I can't say that enough. We are an experiment. We were an experiment station is what we were. Coast to coast was virgin soil, and that produced a lot of food. We invested heavily in technology, and the government for a certain amount of time made some smart decisions on those investments. Land grant, university, college system would be one of them that created a system of investment in agriculture that made us the breadbasket of the world. But all of it was supported by an incredible amount of virgin soil, which is the biggest bank account you can have. We have exhausted that bank account. We've exhausted our free water supply, and we are now living on borrowed time. And we need to change our diet. I just back to what you said is it can't be done unless it's done in the context of pleasure and delight. No one wants to be told what the hell to eat.
Yeah.
No one wants to be told how to vote. No one wants to be told to wear a mask.
They got
to
taste it.
But you cannot tell anybody how to eat because it's your mother wagging your finger in your face. And no way that's going to work.
Okay, I want to ask you about synthetic meat in the context of a protein-based diet. And I mean, for our listeners, when I say synthetic meat, this is a relatively new development in food production. I'm not talking about plants made to taste and chew like meat. I'm talking about our ability to now grow meat in a lab without any animals, meat that is genetically identical to meat from a slaughtered animal. And part of why I'm fascinated by this is the possibility that it could curb, you know, methane emissions, which contribute to climate change. But at the end of last year, Chef Jose Andres signed on to serve Good Meats. That's a company that's producing this. They're lab-grown or cultivated chicken at one of his restaurants. That's pending regulatory review, and he joined their board of directors. Earlier in 2021, Chef Dominique Crenn announced that she was going to serve cultivated chicken at Atelier Crène, and that's also pending regulatory review. I wonder about this development and how you're thinking about lab-grown protein and whether it could shape big agribusiness meat suppliers, and what are the challenges that you see for smaller farming operations?
I mean, the challenges for smaller farming operations and any farming operation is disastrous if this really were to take on. I'm skeptical that this is our future. I mean, you know, they said the same thing about margarine when I was growing up. You know, margarine, why would you ever buy butter? Why would you ever eat butter?
I think I've seen those ads, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just, it was accepted fact, you know. And then I remember the scientist, the great professor of nutrition at Columbia, Joan Gussow, said, I don't eat margarine because I trust cows more than scientists. and I trust chefs. Most chefs aren't touching this stuff. I didn't know about Dominique Crène, but that's unfortunate. My sense is that the disaster waiting to happen is that the people who produce our food, i.e. farmers and farming communities, are the ones who are going to lose out here. The big processors, of which, you know, in the meat industry, there's four or five.
Right.
They're the ones who are going to, that's why they're all in. That's why Cargill's, that's why everybody's investing in this stuff, because they win any way you slice it. What we need is an agricultural system that improves the ecological functioning of the ecosystem. It needs to, we tend to be locked in this notion that agriculture, we should shoot for regenerative, which means less bad than our current agriculture system. And that is the wrong way to think of it. Less bad is, let's take some cows off of the land and their methane production, and let's, cultivate it in a cell, and that's less bad. But the idea that the cow is the problem is the problem. Mm-hmm. That's the problem, you know? It's like, the cow's not the problem. The cow will sequester more carbon than trees if you treat the cow right. The cow is an herbivore. An herbivore takes the sunlight from the sun, uses the energy that it produces from grass, and with its four stomachs, unlike any animal in the world, does what we can't even dream of doing. We can't walk outside and eat a lawn for lunch, you know? They can. And in eating the lawn for lunch, you are stimulating root systems, you are stimulating soil carbon sequestration on a level that far outweighs forests. But you cannot do that in a way that allows you to eat meat twice a day, 7 days a week. We would have to eat a lot less meat. That doesn't mean a vegetarian. It means you would eat according to your region. In this region, in the Hudson Valley, it's 33 degrees out today. I would say meat is a big part of the diet at certain times of the year, but that's not 7 ounces of protein twice a day. Mm. That is meat that democratizes the cow, you know, and allows us to eat delicious food. You have to come back into cooking. And you have to come back and to experience the flavors that are truly delicious. That, to me, that's the most hedonistic existence you can imagine, you know? And like, it's right there for the taking. Yeah. And unfortunately, we're being robbed of our senses when you get these replacement meats, because it's the one fix answer, you know? Mm. And we're being sold that because someone's making a lot of money on it. That's really unfortunate, you know? I was just yesterday talking to a cattle rancher. There is 400 million acres of pasture land in the United States of America that cows graze on until they're sent to a CAFO, until they're sent to a confinement feeding operation for the last couple months. 400 million. You know what? You know how many acres of pasture there was 40 years ago? About 400 million. It's the same thing. That is land that cannot grow grains and cannot grow vegetables and cannot grow tubers. That is grassland. And the best way to manage grassland is with herbivores. And the best way to run herbivores on grassland is through 100% grass feeding with great grass management. They will fatten up beautifully. They won't fatten up as quickly as corn, and they won't be as sickly fatty, and they won't require the antibiotics that they need to live, but they will live the greatest life, and they will be net, not just carbon neutral, they will be net carbon positive if you allow them to do their work. And our job as eaters, whether you are in the middle of Midtown Manhattan or you're on a farm in Indiana, your job as an eater is to respect that relationship. an herbivore, grass, sunlight. That's a very simple relationship, and our responsibility is to respect it. And respecting it means treating it in a way that has reverence. And what we're doing now is we are so removed from biological realities that we think technology can fix everything. That's the problem. All this tech money is running towards agriculture, you know, and nobody understands biology because an impossible burger is the analog to technology. It's the A to B. It's the computer program that you do this and it does that. Biology does not work that way. Biology is infinitely more complex. It's much more interesting, and it's much more complex, and it's natural food. That's a natural system, and a food system that is truly delicious and nutritious is biologically intensive, and that means it's inefficient because that's what biology is, and that's why I'm talking to you, looking at you with two eyes and two nostrils and two ears. It's inefficient, and that's what we need to celebrate and be respectful of. And in our modern food system, we keep thinking of technology solutions as the answer, and we will lose.
We started with bad healthcare outcomes from COVID, bad outcomes from COVID due to underlying comorbidities, right? And in the context of incentives for changing a system, you think we're having a robust enough conversation about food leading to some of those comorbidities and the way we produce food, the way we make food?
Because I don't know. You guys know how to have these conversations. I don't.
We're having it right now.
Yeah, well, you guys can frame it. You know, the way you frame things is so smart. And I don't know how to do, because you come off as so elitist when you're talking to people about changing their diet. You know,
everyone looks at you
and be like, oh, it's more expensive. And it's always expensive. It's always more expensive. And we have to be more sensitive to the expense. And I'm like, you know, I don't know about that, actually. I mean, I wouldn't try and run as a politician on this platform, but I don't know about that. It's like, if I were sitting here with you in 2022. So if I were to sit here with you in 1992, 30 years ago, and I said to you, hey dude, you know, there's just going to be this weird thing called cable, and it's going to be 97% penetration of American households, and you'd be like, whoa, man, that's cool. And I'd be like, no, yeah, but it's going to cost you $150 a month. You'd be like, what? You'd be like, Americans are going to find $150 of disposable income for, you know, for a free TV? No way. That'll never happen. And then I said, hey, and let me just add on one more thing. By 2010, there's going to be this thing called a cell phone, where people are going to find another $150 of disposable income, and the penetration is going to be 90%+ of that too. And you're going to be like, wait a minute, dude, $300 disposable income per month per American? Never. Well, you know what? We figured out how to prioritize that. And if we did the same thing with food, because it's medicine and it's environmental stewardship, we could do the same thing a lot cheaper, a lot cheaper. But, you know, we don't do that. Instead, we take our tax dollars and allow our tax dollars to subsidize 200 million acres of corn and soybeans, of which we don't eat a drop of it, drop. And we feed it through cows, and we call that efficiency. And it is, biologically speaking, the most inefficient system. What if those 200 million acres look like that guy Klaus's farm? What if they grew lentils, and what if they grew buckwheat, and what if it grew barley, and what if it grew all those rotation crops, and there was a market and a distribution system to deliver it at a fair market value? Wouldn't we be in a very different position? 200 million acres of rotational, healthy grains in our diets. Oh my God. Feeding directly to us. That's democratizing our landscape. That is democratizing. What we are doing is the most elitist food system, not just the worst food system in the history of the world, the most elitist, because we're calling it cheap because we subsidize it with our tax dollars. It isn't cheap. It's very expensive. Forget about the costs on the environment. We know that. Forget about the costs from COVID on healthcare. I'm just talking about little dollar for dollar. We're taking our tax dollars and we're allowing it to be spent on that crap. And that all in the name of, you know, food that's affordable for the everyday American. Oh my God, it's such bullshit. And it just, I just now, you know, I'm angry because you look at COVID and you see the destruction, you see the consequences of that kind of policy. And you're like, well, that's, you know, not zero sum. That, man, that really hurts. And, you know, we're exporting this food system around the world. It's not just here. Mm. We're not the only idiots. We are, this lunacy is being exported around the world. And now they're saying, oh, to fight back, we've got to create a cell culture of meat. It's like, oh, come on, man. It's like, this is craziness. So there you go. I gotta be less angry though, because that doesn't work either.
Okay. Well, let's talk about something constructive. I want to end on a positive note anyway, and I want to be mindful of your time because we're coming up on it. I want you to talk a little bit about the role, the political power that chefs have in shaping palates, in determining what's popular by exposing people to what tastes good, setting trends. And then I also would love for you to talk a little bit about what an average person, listeners, can do in their daily choices to support brands, types of agriculture that are healthy for the system, that aren't going to perpetuate the problems we've just been talking about.
Yeah, I'll take the second question first. Second question is, if you had asked me that when I was writing my book, I would have said the answer to what can the average person do is you vote three times a day with your fork, as Michael Pollan likes to say, and it's a very a dramatic vote that you're making, and the food system will change when we vote for change, and we vote one meal at a time. I don't believe that anymore. I just don't believe it. The intensification of corporate food processing and food production and food distribution power is at its apex. And this one meal, one vote thing, it doesn't work anymore. So I still encourage you to opt out of the big food chain and buy locally, buy regionally. I'm not talking about expensive products. I'm talking about rice and beans or whole barley and beans, as some of the most delicious food that I eat on my nights off. And I'm talking about voting. You know, you got to vote. You got to make this stuff into political platforms of change. And there's so many ways into it: environment, health, food, farming.
Because the government props up this
system. Props up the whole system. It is so corrupt. And I'm not sitting here saying, I mean, if I was running for office, I don't know that I'd be sitting here, arguing that, because it's kind of a boring position, but it's so true.
Well,
it's so true.
Is there a thing you'd change? Is there a single thing that comes to mind that, like, we can start here?
Yeah. One thing I would do if I were a consumer is stop eating grain-fed meat or stop drinking grain-fed milk. Mm. If you're going to spend money anywhere in your diet, that's where to go, because beef is central to the problem. And we are feeding into a big lie. And the answer with this technological fix doesn't work. Mm. So I pasture-based animal agriculture, when it comes to beef especially, is a phenomenal fix to a very, very complicated calculus of a problem. And then your first question was about, I forgot what the-
How chefs can chef. Begin to shape
yeah,
this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like, it's weird that I'm a chef talking to you. Escape me. Chefs have this power now. It's weird. I mean, I think it's weird.
It's a political podcast, and we're talking about food.
We were talking
about
chef. Would that have happened 20 years ago?
No.
I would never have had the bully pulpit 20 years ago. I read, not that long ago, I read this poll that said, it was like the 20 professions that are least to most trusted, politicians, want to know where they were on the list, right? By the way, journalists weren't high up there either.
Sure.
But doctors were like 9 or 10. You know who's number one? Chefs.
Really?
Yeah. I thought it was so interesting.
Wow.
I was like, most trusted. I was like, that's interesting. And doesn't that have something to do with the fact that we really are this great French chefs. We're marchands de bonheur. We're merchants of happiness. And that's a nice trade. That's a nice trade to be involved in, because we're only in the pursuit of joyfulness, and pleasure. And that is true. I'm about to say I like every chef in my community, because they're not corrupt or like any other community. But one thing that chefs share, if they're actually a chef, they're a real chef, is this pit bull pursuit of pleasure and hedonism for their diners. Maybe it's because they want to look like better chefs, or because they're environmentalists or anything. It doesn't, nothing. It's, that is what we are hardwired for. And that makes us very trustworthy, actually. Yeah. It's like a good thing, And so, I don't know, I kind of like this idea that we could use chefs and the power of that hedonism to affect cultural shifts. that could be very exciting, you know? And what I said is true earlier about the American diet. The fact that we don't have a food culture is maybe our greatest strength, you know, to fix this, and that we can move in with real speed to affect change. And that, I think, is going to be very exciting future if we can do it right, because it's going to be very delicious.
Chef Dan, thank you so much for making the time today.
Thank you, pal. Nice to be here.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. Podcasts tend to grow based on word of mouth. So if you want to help more people discover Politicology, you can share this episode or one of your favorites with your friend group, your family, or your colleagues. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we'd love to hear from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.